the gig to somebody else, so Wagner didn't write Flying Dutchman for Paris. But by the time he left in 1842, Meyerbeer was still sort of supporting him, writing letters of recommendation, and helped him get Rienzi performed in Dresden in 1842 and the Flying Dutchman in Berlin in 1843.
And yet Wagner seemed in later life supremely ungrateful to Meyerbeer for his support during that time. And of course, Meyerbeer was Jewish. Some people have argued that in a perverse way, it was the gratitude he needed to feel towards Meyerbeer that ultimately stimulated his anti-Semitism.
Sarah? I think that they're sort of very closely related. Certainly his early letters to Meyerbeer are sort of very over the top in their kind of enthusiasm, their devotion to Meyerbeer. Perhaps he's a little bit embarrassed about the tone of these letters. And certainly by 1850, 51, writing to Liszt, telling him what a terrible person Meyerbeer was. And clearly it's related to his jealousy that Meyerbeer managed to make his name in Paris and he didn't. And it all becomes folded into the anti-Semitism, which really becomes more pronounced in the 1850s and 60s.
You're not so sure, though, Tim?
No, well, I'm not so sure about the anti-Semitism side. I think that he felt ashamed of himself for having grovelled to Meyerbeer, which he had to do. I mean, he's a young man, he has no reputation at all. He's trying to make a name for himself. He's very hard up, very poor, and so on. So he grovelled to Meyerbeer, saying he was the greatest man that ever lived, and so on and so forth. And I think subsequently, he realises that what he was trying to do was not true to himself. Rienzi was imitating. And then he gradually sees that what Meyerbeer is producing is grandiloquent, but it's essentially empty, as he described it himself. These are effects without causes. It's always seemed to me to be a brilliant summation of what Meyerbeer's opera is about. There are some people who admire them still, I have to say, of course.
Well, Sarah, I think, is one of those people.
Well, it's true that in his Jewishness in Music pamphlet, he doesn't actually name Meyerbeer, but points to Wagner. He points to a composer of this commercial, empty kind of music, which is grand opera. So it's grand opera that he sort of turns against. But of course, Wagner's take on grand opera, his idea is that the visual spectacle is completely unmotivated, has nothing to do with the music. So his idea of the unification of the arts that he's aiming at with his music dramas, he doesn't see that as what Meyerbeer is doing. Parisians perhaps would disagree. They felt that the sort of experience of all the senses being bombarded, being in the middle of these extraordinary dramas, was more than simply empty effects without causes.
I mean, there's a sort of cultural nationalism going on here, isn't there, Sarah? Because if, as Tim has said, if Paris and France are absolutely the centre of the world of opera, then Wagner continued to be outside the barricades, so to speak.
Yes, and certainly the reception of Wagner, there's a lot of correspondence in the 1850s and then in the wake of Tannhäuser. Part of the writing against Wagner is because he's attacking the sort of conventions, the traditions of French opera. So there's certainly a sort of a fear of Wagnerian music drama as a threat to French opera at a time when it's actually feeling rather insecure.
Wagner's very interesting about going back to Tannhäuser, which is what we ought to be talking about. Wagner's very interesting about the kind of mood in which he found himself when he was writing Tannhäuser between 1843 and 1845. He's come back from Paris, he's come back to Dresden, which he finds very staid and very conservative, very buttoned up. And he says that, this is in a communication to my friends, written rather later, which he says that, A, I wrote it in, quote, an all-consuming state of voluptuous arousal, a state in which Wagner often found himself, and secondly, that he wrote it to express his, again, quote, my revulsion at the modern world. And that revulsion at the modern world was what he brought back from Paris. Paris was, although he called in briefly at London on the way to Paris, Paris was the first real metropolis that he'd ever got to see. It was well over a million by the time he got there in 1839, and it seemed to him to exemplify everything that was wrong about the modern world.
But if that's the case, Tim, then how do we explain Wagner's participation in one of the least sleepy, least buttoned-up things ever to happen in Dresden? And that, of course, was the 1848-49 liberal revolutions, where Wagner, again, was, in this case, literally on the barricades, taking part in an essentially revolutionary act.
I don't think that's surprising at all. As soon as he accepted the job as director of music, Kapellmeister to the King of Saxony back in 1843, he knew he'd made a mistake. He shouldn't have done it. And it's with a great sense of relief that he finds himself in the middle of a revolution in 1848-9. He can break through of that tyrannical situation in which he'd found himself.
He was in some ways informed by French as well as other thinkers who he'd encountered in the previous years. I mean, Proudhon was someone who he'd read and dealt with during that time. He also, I think, met people like Bakunin, Feuerbach and others.
That's true. I mean, he takes from Paris, from that experience back in 39 to 42, he takes a lot of pluses, a lot of positives. Probably the greatest positive, as he put it himself, at least in his autobiography, was that for the first time, he'd heard Beethoven's symphonies played by a really good orchestra, by the orchestra of the Conservatoire. So it just bowled him over. So there are quite a lot of positives coming out of that, those three unhappy years, including acquaintance with French utopian socialists like Proudhon, Fourier and Saint-Simon. And he's moving in an expat. He never really learned the French language properly, so he's moving mainly among expatriate Germans. And they're discussing left-wing socialist theories from the French utopian socialists, but also from the young Hegelians. And the young Hegelians, Feuerbach, for example, have a huge impact on him, a great influence on him throughout the 1840s, and indeed including anarchist writers like Max Stirner.
And he was also a man who once again found himself on the wrong end of a political upheaval. After the uprisings failed, Sarah, Wagner had to flee yet again, this time to Switzerland, where he actually remained in exile for about a dozen years or so. Was it a time when he thought back on his experience in Paris?
Well, he stopped off in Paris on his way to Switzerland. And it's really during his time in Switzerland, he then steps back from sort of direct involvement in political activism. And he writes his sort of revolutionary works about opera. So opera and drama, artwork of the future, art and revolution. And these works are much discussed in Paris. So even though he's not there anymore, Parisians are getting to know him, still don't really know his music, but see him as a revolutionary, a political revolutionary, but also an artistic revolutionary. Liszt writes an important article in one of the national newspapers. And so, although he's not in Paris, his profile is quite high.
Is it fair to say then that Wagner is still in a kind of, well, we've mentioned Hegel before, should we say a dialectic, a conversation, an argument with the French notion of opera, even while he's in exile out there in the Alps?
I think that is right. I mean, it's a dialectical relationship. When he's in Paris, he hates it. When he's out of Paris, he wants to get back again. He often says that.
But there is also quite a polarised reception of him going on in the early 50s in Paris. So on the one hand, we have people like Liszt, literary figures such as Gérard de Nerval, Théophile Gautier, indeed, who are praising him. But then you have a sort of reaction from people like François Fétis, one of the sort of old school who was in Paris, now director of the Brussels Conservatoire, writing about Wagner as a sort of threat, undermining the traditional values of French opera.
Returning to Tannhäuser, Tim, is it fair to say that you can see that the opera carries the imprint of those successive Parisian experiences?
Yes, I do. I think it's an autobiographical opera. I don't think there's any doubt about that. The Venusberg, from which Tannhäuser escapes by announcing the word of the Virgin, is Paris. And the buttoned-up court of the medieval court of the Landgrave Hermann is the court of the King of Saxony, in which Wagner found himself as Kapellmeisters.
After the first three performances, the revised version of Tannhäuser, it has to be said that the curtain came down in a pretty definitive sort of way. In the end, Sarah, do you think that it would be fair to say that rather than thinking of him as a German composer, we need to think of Wagner as being someone who had a significant French-German influence?
Wagner clearly picked up influences from French grand opera, much as he sort of turned against it in his writings later on, picked up influences from Italian opera. So I think it is helpful to see him as more of a Europeanist than we might otherwise do.
Would you buy that argument, Tim?
Yes, I would. I don't think that Wagner was really much of a nationalist. There are.
Oh, there's a statement that you can get an awful lot of people to argue about. What do you mean by that, Tim?
Well, if you read carefully everything he wrote, which I have done, then you will find that the number of overtly nationalist statements are very few and far between. What is more interesting, I think, are the far more numerous statements when he says, I really have nothing in common with these dreadful, dreary people, and he's referring to the Germans, or the Saxons, possibly. And he once says, if I am a German, it's because I carry Germany around inside me. And so for him, Germany was an ideal. It was a cultural and aesthetic ideal, spiritual ideal, if you like, which he carried around inside him. But it had very little to do with the actual, even with the actual geography of Germany. And it certainly had nothing to do with the German Empire created in 1871 by Bismarck, which he ultimately came to hate and despise. He referred to Bismarck famously as a brutal barbarian.
And indeed, if you look at some of his earlier writings as well, he's quite critical about German music, German opera. He has vision in 1834 of the French and the Germans uniting to create a new kind of universal opera. And we tend to forget about those early writings.
Well, we could carry on for ages unwrapping more and more layers of Wagner, but we do have to get back to this evening's performance of Tannhäuser. So could I give my thanks to my two guests, Tim Blanning and Sarah Hibbard.
Wagner in France was presented by Rana Mitter and produced by James Cook. Well, Act 3 of our Lives Proms performance of Tannhäuser continues in about 10 minutes. It features the choir of the Deutsche Oper Berlin, where Donald Runnicles is music director. And this is a very special occasion for them. It's the first time they performed with another orchestra. And it was a personal ambition of Donald Runnicles to bring them together with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. So how are the chorus finding it? Georgia Mann is backstage to find out.
Thanks, Louise. Yes, I'm in the middle of a bustling backstage corridor right now with two members of the Deutsche Oper Berlin Chorus, who, as you say, Donald Runnicles was keen to have here to make their proms debut. I'm with Martina and Angelica. How has the proms experience been so far, ladies?
It has been overwhelming for us. The building is huge and so beautiful, and the acoustic is phenomenal.
I'm glad you said that, because sometimes the acoustic, there have been the odd issue with it, but tell me how you found it.
Well, for me, it's overwhelming too, and my emotions just go crazy right now. Sometimes I have tears in my eyes because I don't know where to listen, what to see, and how to feel about the whole thing here.
I mean, how do you find the audience? Because in your home in Berlin, you're in a much more, you're in a very contemporary space. It's got clean lines, very angular. Here we are in this wonderful rounded Victorian hall with the audience right in front of you, just footsteps away. How is that?
It's very extraordinary. We can see almost everyone in the audience because the light is up. In our house, usually they put the light down so you cannot see much of the audience. So you see that they concentrate and they're all going with the whole piece. It's wonderful.
And I think you even spotted a couple of people playing a bit of tennis upstairs on the gallery when you were singing up there earlier, didn't you, Martina?
Right, there were a little kid who was playing while the mother was listening to the music. Another lady was sleeping or just relaxing or meditating. I have no idea, but it was wonderful to see.
Excellent. And also, Donald Runnicles, obviously very close to the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, and you are singing with them for the first time. This is pretty much the first time you sing with any other orchestra apart from your house orchestra. How has that been, and how is it with Donald, who you are so close to?
Well, it's a wonderful work with Donald Runnicles. It's not the first time we work with, because he is our general music director in Berlin.
But this orchestra is the first time, isn't it?
This orchestra is the first time, that's right. And it's just wonderful how he works with us, how patient he is with us. He keeps calm, he keeps friendly, he's just a great conductor in the front.
Fantastic. Ladies, I will let you get back in the queue because you have to make it back onto stage now for the next act of Tannhäuser. Back to you now, Louise.
Georgia, thanks. Georgia Mann talking to members of the chorus of the Deutsche Oper Berlin. Now, throughout this year, when we broadcast operas by our anniversary composers, Wagner, Verdi and Britten, we're giving you the opportunity to download a guide devoted to each opera. Here's our Tannhäuser guide, which begins with the Wagner specialist, John Dethridge.
Tannhäuser is about a musician. Tannhäuser is Wagner's only hero who is, from the very beginning, a singer. In fact, it's an opera about singers and musicians. But unfortunately, it's also about how a gifted singer like Tannhäuser can be distracted by his own sexual emotions, come into an entanglement with deluded citizens in a middle-class society, a medieval society, but of course it's not difficult to see that that's meant to be mid-19th century society, and then also to suffer indignation at the hands of the church.
Tannhäuser is an opera that deals with several opposing concepts or opposing forces. On the one hand, there's of course the obvious tension between sensual love and spiritual love, as embodied in the two main female characters, Venus and Elizabeth. And of course, the other big tension is the role of the artist in society.
Tannhäuser is a very autobiographical character for Wagner himself. And all Wagner's first three so-called mature operas, this one, The Flying Dutchman, before it, Lohengrin after it, are about the role of the artist in society and also the role of the romantic adventurer in a bourgeois society. And of course, he'd already developed by this stage the form that the more interesting, more neurotic, but also more romantic characters had the adventurous chromatic style of writing and the sort of what you might call the bourgeois normality, like the Landgrave. And I mean, actually, Wolfram as well had the more straightforward sort of diatonic stuff.
In the first act, it's all about what is the most appropriate kind of love for an artist or for a human being. Tannhäuser wants to get away from what he considers now as the stifling embraces of Venus and wants to go back to real life and thinks that he might find inspiration there. The second act, of course, also deals with the theme of love, but in a much more artistic context or in a much more artificial context. So it's a very medieval idea, this cours d'amour, where different poets have to explain their visions of spiritual love in wonderful metaphors, which then, of course, all blows up when Tannhäuser strikes into his praise song for Venus. The third act then returns to the tension of spiritual love embodied in Elisabeth, but also embodied in Wolfram, who has his grand solo scene there, and then sensual love when Venus comes back towards the end to reclaim Tannhäuser for herself. As is well known, there are at least four easily distinguishable versions of Tannhäuser, first recent version of the premiere, then various reworkings, especially of the finale, then the famous Paris version, which caused a scandal in 1861, and finally the version which we nowadays know, which was prepared for Vienna in 1875.
He went so far with Tannhäuser, which caused him a lot of problems at its first performance. He had to keep revising it. So it's the only opera that's now performed where there are so many different versions and little bits and changes that basically any performer can go and take their pick of what to do.
In terms of what it's about, it has, in mini form, virtually his entire life's output in it, because you get a court, which is like Grail Knights, you get a singing competition, which is like the Meistersinger, you get the crux between the sacred and the sensual, which is like any number of works, Lohengrin, of course, too. And he just wanted to go on fiddling with it. On the encouragement of his rather underestimated wife, Minna, he actually wanted to try and achieve a successful grand opera.
And, of course, Wagner had different reasons to prepare each of these reworkings, and quite often they were very basic and to do with practicalities. I think it's also that Wagner realized that he had never quite worked out what the solution to the central problem would be, whether sensual or spiritual love is actually what an artist needs most. And I think his famous remark, I still owe the world a Tannhäuser, which he made a few days before his death. I think that's partly to do with that lack of satisfaction. I mean, you could say that Wagner took the central problem and actually worked it out in some of his later operas in different ways. So if you look at Meistersinger, you have the integration of the artist into society who also gains love. If you look at Tristan, you have sensual love, which becomes paramount, and society just falls by the way, and then the hero and the heroine have to die, or they want to die, because there's no chance to realize their emotions in the real world. And then perhaps you have the solution in Parsifal, where the sensual love is rejected, and only the spiritual element remains. So in a sense, I think that you could explain some of Wagner's later operas as a working out of the central imbalance of Tannhäuser.
In that Radio 3 Opera Guide to Tannhäuser, you heard the voices of Barbara Eichner, Mike Ashman and John Dethridge. And that podcast and all the other Radio 3 Opera Guides are available via the podcast link on the Radio 3 homepage. And the chanting of the Prommers there indicates that Act 3 of our Proms performance approaches. Things don't augur well for Elizabeth. The pilgrims are returning from Rome, but Tannhäuser isn't with them. She sings a prayer to the Virgin, but Wolfram isn't too disappointed. He's deeply in love with Elizabeth and sings his hymn to the evening star. Then Tannhäuser appears and explains to Wolfram that in Rome he was told that the Pope could no more forgive him than his papal staff could sprout green leaves. This leaves Tannhäuser in a desperate state. With Tannhäuser at his weakest, Venus reappears and tries to steal him back. What ensues is essentially a struggle for Tannhäuser's soul between the sacred and the profane. For Elizabeth, Tannhäuser's choice to return to the Venusberg proves too much, and yet she's still able to forgive him. She prays for him as she's about to die. But what causes her death? Heidi Melton.
She dies of a broken heart because this is a person that believes more than anything in forgiveness and fairness and love and all of these things. And she is a very religious person. I wouldn't call her pious at all. But she's very religious, and this is the tenets of her religion, is that she believes in these things. And when he goes off to Rome and he doesn't return with the pilgrims that are forgiven, it's not only him that she's lost, but it's her faith. It's everything all in one huge, crushing blow. And so she sings one last prayer to the Virgin Mary and basically says, please forgive him. And she knows that she's going to die, whether she commits suicide, whether I've seen a production where Wolfram strangles her because he wants her so badly. You know, it doesn't matter. She knows that she's going to die.
Well, that death happens off stage. Venus is vanquished and disappears. Tannhäuser himself collapses, and it's left to the pilgrims to reveal the miracle by which his soul is redeemed. The Pope's staff has sprouted leaves. Just to remind you of the key performers, Tannhäuser is sung by Robert Dean Smith, Elizabeth by Heidi Melton, Venus by Daniela Sindrum, and Wolfram by Christoph Pohl. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra are already led this evening by Laura Samuel. And this applause greets Donald Runicus as he returns for the third and final act in this BBC Proms performance of Tannhäuser, and he's encouraging the members of the Deutsche Oper Chorus to stand, shaking hands with Laura Samuel and bringing the orchestra to their feet before stepping onto the podium to conduct Act 3 of Tannhäuser by Richard Wagner.
ich einsam aus Wald gehüllt, mich in das Tal verirre. Den Tod, den ihr hier gab im Herzen, dahin gestreckt in brünsten Schmerzen, flieht für sein Heil sie Tag. Es ist die fromme Weise, die der empfangenen Gnade heil verkündigt.
Sie kehren nach Hause.
Thank you.
Entschwebt dem Tal der Erden. so einsam wanderst. Wer ich bin, kenn ich noch dich recht gut. Wolfram bist du, ihr wohlgeübter Sänger. Heinrich, was bringt dich hier in diesen Erdstrich? Fragst du es unentsündigt, noch den Fuß nach dieser Gegend her zu lenken? Sei außer Sorg, ein guter Sänger. Nicht such ich dich noch deiner Sippschaft einen. Doch such ich wen, der mir den Weg wohl zeige, den Weg, den ein so wunderleicht ich fand. Und welchen Weg? Den Weg zum Lebensberg. Entsetzlicher, entfreie nicht mein Ohr, bleib es dich dahin. Kennst du wohl den Weg, du Wahnsinniger? Raus entfasst mich, hör ich dich. Wo fahrst du? Zogst du denn nicht nach Rom? Schweig mir von Rom! Fass nicht beim heiligen Feste! Schweig mir von ihm! So warst du nicht, sag ich, beschwöre dich! Wohl worauf ich in Rom. So sprich, erzähle mir, Unglücklicher, mich fasst ein tiefes Mitleid für dich an.
Das Haar mich, wo ich der Wahrheit lust, so viel genoss an ihrer warmen Brust. Zu dir, Frau Venus, kehr ich wieder in deine zauberholde Nacht, zu deinem Hof.
In her dying act, Elizabeth prays for the errant knight Tannhäuser. Venus vanishes, the papal staff sprouts green leaves, and Tannhäuser's soul is saved at the end of Wagner's opera. A fantastic reception here from the Royal Albert Hall, continuing our Wagner anniversary tribute at the 2013 Proms. Donald Runnicles on the podium conducting the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and the chorus of the Deutsche Oper Berlin. And he's swift to step down from the podium to encourage tenor Robert Dean Smith singing the role of Tannhäuser, and Wolfram baritone Christoph Pohl, who was standing at the front of the stage there, to take a bow. Elizabeth was sung by Heidi Melton, soprano. She's an Adler Fellow at the San Francisco Opera. Earlier this season, she sang the roles of both Venus and Elizabeth in a production of Tannhäuser at Karlsruhe. She's making her Proms debut this evening. And here come the cast of soloists. Venus was sung by Daniela Sindrum, the German mezzo-soprano. The Landgrave by Ein Anger, bass. Falter by Thomas Blondell, Heinrich, Andrew Rees, Reinmar by Brian Ballantyne Scott, Bitterolf by Ashley Holland, and the Shepherd Boy, Hila Fahima. All of them lining up at the front of the stage, and Donald Runnicles encouraging the chorus to stand. That cheer was for them. All the members of the orchestra and the soloists joining in the applause. The chorus master, William Spalding. Christopher Willis was the offstage conductor, and Justin Way, the stage director for this semi-staged production. Or Samuel leading the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. Well, don't forget, our Tannhäuser Opera Guide is available to download from the Radio 3 website, together with all the other guides to the operas by anniversary composers, Wagner, Verdi and Britten, that have been broadcast so far this year. And Parsifal will be the next Wagner opera to receive a Proms performance. That's in 3 weeks' time. Sir Mark Elder conducting the Halle. Donald Runnicles and the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra will be taking the Verdi Requiem to the Edinburgh Festival at the end of August. Before that, the orchestra is back here on the 18th and 19th with Matthias Pinscher conducting Stravinsky's Firebird and his own double trumpet concerto for Marcus Plau and Tina Ting-Helset. Coincidentally, tomorrow lunchtime, there's the next of our Proms chamber concerts live from Cadogan Hall, featuring Ten Ting, the brass ensemble led by Tina Ting-Helset. And tomorrow evening we'll be back here at the Royal Albert Hall to see the BBC Philharmonic reunited with their former chief conductor, Gianandrea Nezeda. That's in a set of Russian works, including Prokofiev's second piano concerto, John F. Lambavazé, the soloist, and giving the world premiere of Earth Music 1 by Edward Cowie. But for now, that's all from the Royal Albert Hall. I'll hand you back to Katrina Young.
Thank you, Louise. That was Louise Fryer. And don't forget, every prom stays on the Radio 3 website for 7 days after the performance, so there's a chance, if you'd like, to listen to it again. And the other programme that's still available, if you missed it last night, is the second in the Proms Extra series being broadcast on BBC Two. Yesterday, Katie Derham was joined by Julian Joseph, the composer Tarik O'Regan, and the ballerina Tamara Rocco. They looked back over another week of proms, including a performance of Ravel's Bolero by the BBC Philharmonic under their Spanish conductor, Juanjo Mena. That was in Proms Extra on BBC Two, which you can watch anytime before next Saturday on the BBC iPlayer.
BBC Radio 3 at Proms Plus. Free events across the 2013 Proms season, capturing the musical, literary and artistic background to some of the featured music and themes. Go to the Radio 3 website or the BBC iPlayer radio app to hear some of the Proms Plus events so far, including author John le Carré celebrating 50 years since the publication of The Spy Who Came In from the Cold.
We all of us instinctively incline towards the conspiratorial moment and, quite simply, the patriotic moment.
BBC Proms Plus. Go online to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Well, the next prom on offer, as Louise mentioned earlier, is by the Norwegian trumpeter Tina Ting Helset, who will be bringing her ensemble Ten Ting to Cadogan Hall at lunchtime tomorrow. It's a 10-piece brass ensemble, all female, and they've got a very eclectic programme with a world premiere at the centre of it. A piece called Blaze, a BBC commission from Diana Burrell, and there are arrangements of Grieg, Kurzweil and Bizet as well. That's at 1 o'clock tomorrow. And Louise also mentioned the 70th birthday of Edward Cowie being celebrated tomorrow night at the Royal Albert Hall. And other than that, a Russian programme. So by way of a little taster, as it were, here's Margaret Fingerhut with a Russian nationalist, Balakirev.